This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. Read for you by Jim Broadbent.
For Paul, who walks with me, and for my father, Martin Joyce, 1936 to 2005. Who would true valor see? Let him come hither. One here will constant be, come wind, come weather. There's no discouragement shall make him once relent his first avowed intent to be a pilgrim. John Bunyan, The Pilgrim's Progress. Chapter 1. Harold and the Letter. The letter that would change everything arrived on a Tuesday. It was an ordinary morning in mid-April that smelt of clean washing and grass cuttings. Harold Fry sat at the breakfast table, freshly shaved, in a clean shirt and tie, with a slice of toast that he wasn't eating. He gazed beyond the kitchen window at the clipped lawn, which was spiked in the middle by Maureen's telescopic washing line, and trapped on all three sides by the neighbour's close-board fencing.
"Harold!" called Maureen above the vacuum cleaner. "Post!"
He thought he might like to go out, but the only thing to do was mow the lawn, and he had done that yesterday. The vacuum tumbled into silence, and his wife appeared, looking cross, with a letter. She sat opposite Harold. Maureen was a slight woman with a cap of silver hair and a brisk walk. When they first met, nothing had pleased him more than to make her laugh, to watch her neat frame collapse into unruly happiness.
"It's for you," she said.
He didn't know what she meant until she slid an envelope across the table and stopped it just short of Harold's elbow. They both looked at the letter as if they had never seen one before. It was pink.
"The postmark says Berwick-upon-Tweed."
He didn't know anyone in Berwick. He didn't know many people anywhere.
"Well, maybe it's a mistake."
"I think not. They don't get something like a postmark wrong." She took toast from the rack. She liked it cold and crisp. Harold studied the mysterious envelope. Its pink was not the colour of the bathroom suite or the matching towels and fluffed cover for the toilet seat. That was a vivid shade that made Harold feel he shouldn't be there. But this was delicate, a Turkish delight pink. His name and address were scribbled in biro, the clumsy letters collapsing into one another as if a child had dashed them off in a hurry. "Mr. H. Fry, 13 Fosbridge Road, Kingsbridge, South Hams." He didn't recognize the handwriting.
"Well?"
said Maureen, passing a knife. He held it to the corner of the envelope and tugged it through the fold.
"Careful,"
she warned. He could feel her eyes on him as he eased out the letter and prodded back his reading glasses. The page was typed and addressed from a place he didn't know. St. Bernardine's Hospice. "Dear Harold, this may come to you as some surprise." His eyes ran to the bottom of the page.
"Well?"
said Maureen again. "Good Lord, it's from Queenie Hennessy." Maureen speared a nugget of butter with her knife and flattened it the length of her toast.
"Queenie who?"
"She worked at the brewery years ago, don't you remember?" Maureen shrugged. "I don't see why I should. I don't know why I'd remember someone from years ago. Could you pass the jam?"
"She was in finances. She was very good."
"That's the marmalade, Harold. Jam is red. If you look at things before you pick them up, you'll find it helps."
Harold passed her what she needed and returned to his letter. Beautifully set out, of course. Nothing like the muddled writing on the envelope. Then he smiled. Remembering this was how it always was with Queenie. Everything she did so precise you couldn't fault it.
"She remembers you. She sends her regards."
Maureen's mouth pinched into a bead.
"A chap on the radio was saying the French want our bread. They can't get it sliced in France. They come over here and they buy it all up. The chap said there might be a shortage by summer."
She paused.
"Harold? Is something the matter?"
He said nothing, He drew himself up tall, with his lips parted, his face bleached. His voice, when at last it came, was small and far away.
"It's cancer. Queenie is writing to say goodbye."
He fumbled for more words, but there weren't any. Tugging a handkerchief from his trouser pocket, Harold blew his nose.
Gosh!
Tears crammed his eyes. Moments passed. Maybe minutes. Maureen gave a swallow that smacked the silence. "I'm sorry," she said. He nodded. He ought to look up, but he couldn't.
"It's a nice morning," she began again. "Why don't you fetch out the patio chairs?"
But he sat, not moving, not speaking, until she lifted the dirty plates. Moments later, the vacuum cleaner took up from the hall. Harold felt winded. If he moved so much as a limb, even a muscle, he was afraid it would trigger an abundance of feeling he was doing his best to contain. Why had he let 20 years pass without trying to find Queenie Hennessy? A picture came of the small, dark-haired woman with whom he had worked all that time ago. And it seemed inconceivable that she was, what, 60? And dying of cancer in Berwick? Of all the places, he thought, he had never travelled so far north. He glanced out at the garden and saw a ribbon of plastic caught in the laurel bush, flapping up and down but never pulling free. He tucked Queenie's letter into his pocket, patted it twice for safekeeping, and rose to his feet. Upstairs, Maureen shut the door of David's room quietly and stood a moment, breathing him in. She pulled open his blue curtains that she closed every night and checked there was no dust where the hem of the net drapes met the windowsill. She polished the silver frame of his Cambridge portrait and the black-and-white baby photograph beside it. She kept the room clean because she was waiting for David to come back, and she never knew when that would be. A part of her was always waiting. Men had no idea what it was like to be a mother. The ache of loving a child, even when he had moved on. She thought of Harold downstairs with his pink letter, and wished she could talk to their son. Maureen left the room as softly as she had entered it, and went to strip the beds. Harold Fry took several sheets of Basildon Bond from the dresser drawer, and one of Maureen's rollerball pens. "What did you say to a dying woman with cancer?" He wanted her to know how sorry he felt, but it was wrong to put in sympathy, because that was what the cards in the shop said after, as it were, the event. And anyway, it sounded formal, as if he didn't really care. He tried, "Dear Miss Hennessy, I sincerely hope your condition improves." But when he put down the pen to inspect his message, it seemed both stiff and unlikely. He crumpled the paper into a ball and tried again. He had never been good at expressing himself. What he felt was so big it was difficult to find the words, and even if he could, it was hardly appropriate to write them to someone he had not contacted in 20 years. Had the shoe been on the other foot, Queenie would have known what to do.
"Harold?"
Maureen's voice took him by surprise. He thought she was upstairs polishing something or speaking to David. She had her marigolds on.
"I'm writing Queenie a note."
"A note?" She often repeated what he said.
"Yes, would you like to sign?"
"I think not.
It would hardly be appropriate to sign a note to someone I don't know."
It was time to stop worrying about expressing anything beautifully. He would simply have to set down the words in his head. "Dear Queenie, thank you for your letter. I am very sorry. Yours," crossed out. "Best wishes, Harold brackets Fry." It was limp, but there it was. Sliding the letter into an envelope, he sealed it quickly and copied the address of St. Bernardine's Hospice onto the front.
"I'll nip to the post box."
It was past 11 o'clock. He lifted his waterproof jacket from the peg where Maureen liked him to hang it. At the door, the smell of warmth and salt air rushed at his nose, but his wife was at his side before his left foot was over the threshold.
"Will you be long?"
"I'm only going to the end of the road."
She kept on looking up at him, with her moss-green eyes and her fragile chin. And he wished he knew what to say, but he didn't. At least not in a way that would make any difference. He longed to touch her, like in the old days, to lower his head on her shoulder and rest there.
"Cheerio, Maureen."
He shut the front door between them, taking care not to let it slam. Built on a hill above Kingsbridge, the houses of Fosbridge Road enjoyed what estate agents called an elevated position, with far-reaching views over the town and countryside. Their front gardens, however, sloped at a precarious angle towards the pavement below, and plants wrapped themselves round bamboo stakes as if hanging on for dear life. Harold strode down the steep concrete path a little faster than he might have wished, and noticed 5 new dandelions. Maybe this afternoon he would get out the roundup. It would be something. Spotting Harold, the next-door neighbour waved and steered his way towards the adjoining fence. Rex was a short man with tidy feet at the bottom, a small head at the top, and a very round body in the middle, causing Harold to fear sometimes that if he fell there would be no stopping him. He would roll down the hill like a barrel. Rex had been widowed 6 months ago, at about the time of Harold's retirement. Since Elizabeth's death, he liked to talk about how hard life was. He liked to talk about it at great length.
"The least you can do is listen," Maureen said,
although Harold wasn't sure if she meant you in the general sense or the particular.
"Off for a walk," said Rex.
Harold attempted a jocular tone that would act, he hoped, as an intimation that now was not the time to stop.
"Need anything posting, old chap?" "Nobody writes to me. Since Elizabeth passed away, I only get circulars."
Rex gazed into the middle distance, and Harold recognized at once the direction the conversation was heading. He threw a look upwards. Puffs of cloud sat on a tissue paper sky.
"Jolly nice day."
"Jolly nice," said Rex.
There was a pause, and Rex poured a sigh into it.
"Elizabeth liked the sun."
Another pause.
"Good day for mowing, Rex."
"Very good, Harold. Do you compost your grass cuttings, or do you mulch?"
"I find mulching leaves a mess that sticks to my feet. Maureen doesn't like it when I tread things into the house."
Harold glanced at his yachting shoes, and wondered why people wore them when they had no intention of sailing.
"Well, must get on. Catch the midday collection."
Wagging his envelope, Harold turned towards the pavement. For the first time in his life, it was a disappointment to find that the post-box cropped up sooner than expected. Harold tried to cross the road to avoid it, but there it was, waiting for him on the corner of Fosbridge Road. He lifted his letter for Queenie to the slot and stopped. He looked back at the short distance his feet had travelled. The detached houses were stuccoed and washed in shades of yellow, salmon and blue. Some still had their pointed 50s roofs, with decorative beams in the shape of a half-sun. Others had slate-clad loft extensions. One had been completely rebuilt in the style of a Swiss chalet. Harold and Maureen had moved here 45 years ago, just after they were married. It took all his savings to pay the deposit. There'd been nothing left for curtains or furniture. They had kept themselves apart from others, and over time neighbours had come and gone, while only Harold and Maureen remained. There had once been vegetable beds and an ornamental pond. She made chutneys every summer, and David kept goldfish. Behind the house there had been a potting shed that smelt of fertilizer, with high hooks for hanging tools and coils of twine and rope. But these things, too, were long since gone. Even their son's school, which had stood a stone's throw from his bedroom window, had been bulldozed now and replaced with 50 affordable homes in bright primary colours and street lighting in the style of Georgian gas lamps. Harold thought of the words he had written to Queenie, and their inadequacy shamed him. He pictured himself returning home, and Maureen calling David, and life being exactly the same, except for Queenie dying in Berwick. And he was overcome. The letter rested on the dark mouth of the postbox. He couldn't let it go. "After all," he said out loud, though nobody was looking, "it's a nice day." He hadn't anything else to do. He might as well walk to the next one. He turned the corner of Fossbridge Road before he could change his mind. It was not like Harold to make a snap decision. He saw that. Since his retirement, days went by and nothing changed. Only his waist thickened, and he lost more hair. He slept poorly at night, and sometimes he did not sleep at all. Yet, arriving more promptly than he expected at a pillarbox, he paused again. He had started something, and he didn't know what it was. But now he was doing it, he wasn't ready to finish. Beads of perspiration sprouted over his forehead. His blood throbbed with anticipation. If he took his letter to the post office on 4th Street, it would be guaranteed next-day delivery. The sun pressed warm on the back of his head and shoulders as he strolled down the avenues of new housing. Harold glanced in at people's windows, and sometimes they were empty, and sometimes people were staring right back at him, and he felt obliged to rush on. Sometimes, though, there was an object that he didn't expect, a porcelain figure or a vase or even a tuba. The tender pieces of themselves that people staked as boundaries against the outside world. He tried to visualize what a passerby would learn about himself and Maureen from the windows of 13 Fossbridge Road, before he realized it would not be very much, on account of the net curtains. He headed for the quayside, with the muscles twitching in his thighs. The tide was out, and dinghies lolled in a moonscape of black mud, needing paint. Harold hobbled to an empty bench, inched Queenie's letter from his pocket, and unfolded it. She remembered. After all these years, and yet he had lived out his ordinary life as if what she had done meant nothing. He hadn't tried to stop her. He hadn't followed. He hadn't even said goodbye. The sky and pavement blurred into one as fresh tears swelled his eyes. Then through them came the watery outline of a young mother and child. They seemed to be holding ice cream cones, and bore them like torches. She lifted the boy and sat him down on the other end of the bench. "Lovely day," said Harold, not wanting to sound like an old man who was crying. She didn't look up or agree. Bending over her child's fist, she licked a smooth path to stop the ice cream from running. The boy watched his mother, so still and close, it was as if his face was part of hers. Harold wondered if he had ever sat by the quay eating ice cream with David. He was sure he must have done, although searching in his mind for the memory, he found it wasn't readily available. He must get on. He must post his letter. Office workers were laughing with lunchtime pints outside the Old Creek Inn, but Harold barely noticed. As he began the steep climb up 4th Street, he thought about the mother who was so absorbed in her son she saw no one else. It occurred to him it was Maureen who spoke to David and told him the news. It was Maureen who had always written Harold's name, Dad, in the letters and cards. It was even Maureen who had found the nursing home for his father. And it begged the question, as he pushed the button at the Pelican Crossing, that if she was, in effect, Harold, then who am I? He strode past the post office without even stopping. Chapter 2. Harold and the Garage Girl and a Question of Faith. Harold was near the top of 4th Street. He had passed the closed-down Woolworths, the bad butcher, he beats his wife, Maureen said, the good butcher, his wife left him, the clock tower, the shambles, as well as the offices of the South Hams Gazette. And now he was at the last of the shops. The muscles in his calves pulled with every step. Behind him, the estuary shone like a sheet of tin against the sun. Boats were already tiny flecks of white. He paused at the travel agent, because he wanted to take a rest without anyone noticing, and pretended to read about bargain holidays in the window. Bali, Naples, Istanbul, Dubai. His mother used to talk so dreamily about escaping to countries where there were tropical trees and women with flowers in their hair, that as a boy he had instinctively distrusted the world he did not know. It had not been very different once he was married to Maureen and they had David. Every year they spent 2 weeks in the same holiday camp in Eastbourne. Taking several deep breaths to steady his chest, Harold continued north. The shops turned into homes, some built in pinky-grey Devon stone, some painted, others fronted with slate tiles, followed by cul-de-sacs of new housing. Magnolias were coming into flower, frilled white stars against branches so bare they looked stripped. It was already 1 o'clock. He had missed the midday collection. He would buy a snack to tide him over, and then he would find the next postbox. After waiting for a gap in the traffic, Harold crossed towards a petrol station, where the houses stopped and the fields took over. A young girl at the till yawned. She wore a red tabard over a T-shirt and trousers, with a badge that said, "Happy to Help." Her hair hung in oily strips either side of her head, so that her ears poked through, and her skin was pockmarked and pale, as if she had been kept inside for a long time. She didn't know what he was talking about when he asked for light refreshments. She opened her mouth, and it remained hanging ajar, so that he feared a change in the wind would leave her like that. "A snack?" he said. "Something to keep me going?" Her eyes flickered. "Oh, you mean a burger?" She trudged to the fridge and showed him how to heat a barbecue cheese beast with fries in the microwave. "Good Lord," said Harold as they watched it revolve in its box behind the window. "I had no idea you could get a full meal from a garage." The girl fetched the burger from the microwave and offered sachets of ketchup and brown sauce. "Are you paying for fuel?" she asked, slowly wiping her hands. They were small as a child's. "No, no, I'm just passing, walking, actually." "Oh," she said. "I'm posting a letter to someone I knew once. I'm afraid she has cancer." To his horror, he found that he paused before saying the word and lowered his voice. He also found he had made a small nugget shape with his fingers. The girl nodded. "My aunt had cancer," she said. "I mean, it's everywhere." She cast her eyes up and down the shop shelves, suggesting it was even to be found tucked behind the AA road maps and turtle wax polish. "You have to keep positive, though." Harold stopped eating his burger and mopped his mouth with a paper serviette. "Positive?" "You have to believe, that's what I think. It's not about medicine and all that stuff. You have to believe a person can get better. There's so much in the human mind we don't understand, but you see, if you have faith, you can do anything." Harold gazed at the girl in awe. He didn't know how it had happened, but she seemed to be standing in a pool of light, as if the sun had moved, and her hair and skin shone with luminous clarity. Maybe he was staring too hard, because she gave a shrug and chewed her lower lip. "Am I talking crap?"
"Gosh, no, not at all. It's very interesting. I'm afraid religion is not something I ever quite got the hang of."
"I don't mean, like, religious. I mean trusting what you don't know and going for it, believing you can make a difference."
She twined a strand of hair around her finger. Harold felt he had never come across such simple certainty, and in such a young person. She made it sound obvious.
And she got better, did she? Your aunt, because you believed she could?
A strand of hair was twiddled so tightly round her finger, he was now afraid it was stuck.
She said it gave her hope when everything else had gone.
"Does anyone work here?"
shouted a man in a pinstripe suit from the counter. He wrapped his car keys on the hard surface, beating out wasted time. The girl threaded her way back to the till, where the pinstripe made a show of checking his watch. He held his wrist high in the air and pointed to the dial.
"I'm supposed to be in Exeter in 30 minutes.
"Fuel?"
said the girl, resuming her place in front of cigarettes and lottery tickets. Harold tried to catch her eye, but she wouldn't. She'd returned to being dull and empty again, as if their conversation about her aunt had never happened. Harold left his money for the burger on the counter and made his way to the door. Faith? Wasn't that the word she'd used? Not one he usually heard, but it was strange. Even though he wasn't sure what she meant by faith, or what there was left that he believed in, the word rang in his head with an insistence that bewildered him. At 65 he had begun to anticipate difficulties, a stiffening of the joints, a dull ringing in his ears, eyes that watered with the slightest change in the wind, a dart of chest pain that presaged something more ominous. But what was this sudden surge of feeling that made his body shake with its sheer energy? He turned in the direction of the A381 and promised again that at the next postbox he would stop. He was leaving Kingsbridge. The road narrowed into a single lane until the pavement disappeared altogether. Above him the branches joined like the roof of a tunnel, tangled with pointed new buds and clouds of blossom. More than once he had to crush himself into a hawthorn to avoid a passing car. There were single drivers, and he supposed they must be office workers, because their faces appeared fixed, as if the joy had been squeezed away. And then there were women driving children, and they looked tired too. Even the older couples, like himself and Maureen, had a rigidity about them. An impulse to wave came over Harold. He didn't, though. He was wheezing with the effort of walking, and he didn't want to cause alarm. The sea lay behind. Before him stretched rolling hills and the blue outline of Dartmoor. And beyond that, the Blackdown Hills, the Mendips, the Malverns, the Pennines, the Yorkshire Dales, the Cheviots, and Berwick-upon-Tweed. But here, directly across the road, stood a postbox, and a little way beyond it a telephone booth. Harold's journey was over. He dragged his feet. He had seen so many he had lost count, as well as 2 Royal Mail vans and a courier on a motorbike. Harold thought of all the things in life he had let go. The small smiles. The offers of a beer. The people he had passed over and over again in the brewery car park or on the street, without lifting his head. The neighbours whose forwarding addresses he had never kept. Worse, the son who didn't speak to him, and the wife he had betrayed. He remembered his father in the nursing home, and his mother's suitcase by the door. And now here was a woman who 20 years ago had proved herself a friend. Was this how it went? That just at the moment when he wanted to do something, it was too late? That all the pieces of a life must eventually be surrendered, as if in truth they amounted to nothing? The knowledge of his helplessness pressed down on him so heavily he felt weak. It wasn't enough to send a letter. There must be a way to make a difference. Reaching for his mobile, Harold realized it was at home. He staggered into the road, his face thick with grief. A van shrieked to a halt and then skirted past.
"You stupid fucker!"
yelled the driver. He barely heard. He barely saw the postbox either. Queenie's letter was in his hands before the door of the telephone kiosk had closed behind him. He found the address and telephone number, but his fingers shook so hard he could barely tap the buttons to enter his PIN code. He waited for the ringing tone, and the air hung still and heavy. A trickle of sweat slid between his shoulder blades. After 10 rings, there was at last a clunk, and a heavily accented voice.
St. Bernardine's Hospice, good afternoon.
I'd like to speak to a patient, please. Her name is Queenie Hennessy. There was a pause. He added, It's very urgent. I need to know that she's all right. The woman made a sound as if she was breathing out a long sigh. Harold's spine chilled. Queenie was dead. He was too late. He clamped his knuckle to his mouth. The voice said, I'm afraid Miss Hennessy is asleep. Can I take a message? Small clouds sent shadows scurrying across the land. The light was smoky over the distant hills, not with the dusk, but with the map of space that lay ahead. He pictured Queenie dozing at one end of England and himself in a phone box at the other, with things in between that he didn't know and could only imagine. Roads, fields, rivers, woods, moors, peaks and valleys, and so many people. He would meet and pass them all. There was no deliberation, no reasoning. The decision came in the same moment as the idea. He was laughing at the simplicity of it. Tell her Harold Fry is on his way. All she has to do is wait, because I am going to save her, you see. I will keep walking, and she must keep living. Will you say that? The voice said she would. Was there anything else? Did he know visiting hours, for instance, parking restrictions? He insisted. I'm not in a car. I want her to live.
I'm sorry, did you say something about your car?
I'm coming by foot from South Devon all the way up to Berwick-upon-Tweed. The voice gave an exasperated sigh.
It's a terrible line. What are you doing?
I'm walking, he shouted.
I see,
said the voice slowly, as if the woman had picked up a pen and was jotting this down.
Walking. I'll tell her. Should I say anything else?
I'm setting off right now. As long as I walk, she must live. Please tell her this time I won't let her down. When Harold hung up and stepped out of the phone box, his heart was pounding so fast it felt too big for his chest. With trembling fingers, he unpeeled the flap of his own envelope and pulled out the reply. Cramming it against the glass of the kiosk, he scribbled a P.S. Wait for me. H. He posted the letter, without noticing its loss. Harold stared at the ribbon of road that lay ahead, and the glowering wall that was Dartmoor, and then the yachting shoes that were on his feet. He asked himself what in heaven's name he had just done. Overhead, a seagull cracked its wings and laughed. Chapter 3 Maureen and the Telephone Call. The useful thing about a sunny day was that it showed up the dust and dried the laundry in almost less time than the tumble dryer. Maureen had squirted, bleached, polished and annihilated every living organism on the worktops. She had washed and aired the sheets, pressed them and remade the beds for both herself and Harold. It had been a relief to have him out of the way. In the 6 months of his retirement, he had barely moved from the house. But now that she had nothing left to achieve, she was suddenly anxious, and this in turn made her impatient. She rang Harold's mobile, only to hear a marimba tone coming from upstairs. She listened to his faltering message.
You have reached the mobile phone of Harold Fry. I'm very sorry, but he isn't here.
From the long pause he took in the middle, you'd think he was actually off looking for himself. It was past 5. He never did the unexpected. Even the usual noises, the ticking of the hall clock, the hum of the fridge were louder than they should be. Where was he? Maureen tried to distract herself with the telegraph crossword, only to discover he had filled in all the easy answers. A terrible thought rushed into her head. She pictured him lying in the road with his mouth open. It happened. People had heart attacks and no one found them for days. Or maybe her secret fears were confirmed. Maybe he would end up with Alzheimer's like his father. The man was dead before 60. Maureen ran to fetch the car keys and her driving shoes. And then it occurred to her that he was probably with Rex. They were probably talking about lawn cutting and the weather. Ridiculous man. She replaced her shoes by the front door and the car keys on their hook. Maureen crept into the room that had become known over the years as the best one. She could never enter it without feeling she needed a cardigan. Once they'd kept a mahogany dining table and four upholstered chairs. They'd eaten in here every evening with a glass of wine. But that was 20 years ago. These days the table was gone, and the bookshelves stored albums of photographs that no one opened. "Where are you?" she said. The net curtains hung between herself and the outside world, robbing it of colour and texture, and she was glad of that. The sun was already beginning to sink. Soon the street lamps would be on. When the phone rang, Maureen shot into the hallway and plucked up the receiver. "Harold?" A thick pause.
"It's Rex, Maureen, from next door."
She looked about her helplessly. In her rush to answer the phone, she had stubbed her foot on something angular that Harold must have left on the floor.
"Are you all right, Rex? Have you run out of milk again?"
"Is Harold home?"
"Harold?"
Maureen felt her voice shoot upwards. If he wasn't with Rex, where was he?
"Yes, of course he's here."
The tone she had adopted was not at all her usual one. She sounded both regal and squashed, just like her mother.
"Only I was worried something had happened. I didn't see him come back from his walk. He was going to post a letter."
Devastating images were already firing through her mind of ambulances and policemen, and herself holding Harold's inert hand, and she didn't know if she was being completely foolish, but it was as if her head was rehearsing the worst possible outcome in order to preempt the full shock of it. She repeated that Harold was at home, and then before he could ask anything else she hung up. She immediately felt terrible. Rex was 74 and lonely. All he wanted was to help. She was about to call back when he beat her to it and the phone began ringing in her hand. Maureen reassembled her composed voice and said,
"Good evening, Rex."
"It's me." Her composed voice rocketed sky high.
"Harold, where are you?"
"I'm on the B3196, just outside the pub at Lottiswell." He actually sounded pleased. Between the front door and Lottiswell, there were almost 5 miles. So he hadn't had a heart attack and fallen into the road. He hadn't forgotten who he was. She felt more indignant than relieved. Then a new, terrible thought dawned on her.
"You haven't been drinking."
"I had a lemonade, but I feel brilliant. Better than I've felt in years. I met a nice chap who sells satellite dishes." He paused as if he was about to deliver portentous news. "I've made a promise to walk, Maureen. All the way to Berwick." She thought she must have misheard.
"Walk? To Berwick-upon-Tweed? You?"
He appeared to find this very funny.
"Yes, yes,"
he spluttered. Maureen swallowed. She felt her legs and her voice failing her. She said,
"Let me get this clear. You're walking to see Queenie Hennessy."
"I'm going to walk, and she's going to live. I'm going to save her." Her knees buckled. She threw her hand out to the wall to steady herself.
"I think not. You can't save people from cancer, Harold, not unless you are a surgeon, and you can't even slice bread without making a mess. This is ridiculous."
Again Harold laughed,
as if this person they were talking about was a stranger and not himself. "I was talking to a girl at the garage, and she gave me the idea. She saved her aunt from cancer because she believed she could. She showed me how to heat a burger as well. It even had gherkins." He came across as so sure, it completely threw her. Maureen felt a spark of heat.
"Harold, you are 65. You only ever walk to get to the car, and in case you haven't noticed, you left your mobile phone."
He tried to reply, but she sailed straight through him.
"And where do you think you are going to sleep?"
"I don't know." The laughter had stopped and his voice sounded stripped away. "But it isn't enough to post a letter. Please. I need to do this, Maureen." The way he appealed to her, and added her name at the end, childlike, as if the choice was hers, when clearly he had already decided, was too much. The spark of heat ignited to a bolt. She said,
"Well, you head off to Berwick, Harold, if that's what you want. I'd like to see you get past Dartmoor."
The line was staccatoed with pips. She tightened her grip on the handset as if it was a piece of him she was clinging to.
"Harold, are you still in the pub?"
"No, a phone box outside. It's quite smelly. I think someone may have..." His voice cut off. He was gone. Maureen groped her body into the hall chair. The silence was louder than if he had not phoned at all. It seemed to eat up everything else. There was no ticking from the hall clock, no humming from the fridge, no birdsong from the garden. The words Harold, burger, walk, rolled around her head, and in the midst of them came two more. Queenie Hennessy. After all these years, the memory of something long buried shivered deep inside her. Maureen sat alone as the dark fell, while neon lights came on across the hills and bled pools of amber into the night. Chapter 4. Harold and the Hotel Guests. Harold Fry was a tall man who moved through life with a stoop, as if expecting a low beam or a screwed-up paper missile to appear out of nowhere. The day he was born, his mother had looked at the bundle in her arms and felt appalled. She was young, with a peony-bud mouth, and a husband who had seemed a good idea before the war and a bad one after it. A child was the last thing she wanted or needed. The boy learned quickly that the best way to get along in life was to keep a low profile, to appear absent even when present. He played with neighbours' children, or at least he watched them from the edges. At school he avoided attention to the point of appearing stupid. Leaving home when he was 16, he had set out on his own, until one night he caught Maureen's eye across a dance hall and fell wildly in love. It was the brewery that had brought the newlywed couple to Kingsbridge. Harold had done the same job as a sales rep for 45 years. Keeping himself apart, he worked modestly and efficiently, without seeking either promotion or attention. Other chaps travelled and accepted jobs in senior management, but Harold had not wanted either. He made neither friends nor enemies. At his request, there was no farewell party for his retirement, and even though one of the girls in admin had organised a quick whip-round, few of the sales team knew much about him. Someone said they'd heard once that Harold had a story, but didn't know what it was. He finished work on a Friday and returned home with no more to show for his lifetime's employment than a fully illustrated motorist's guide to Great Britain and a voucher for Threshers. The book had been placed in the best room, along with all the other things that no one looked at. The voucher remained in its envelope. Harold was teetotal. Gnawing hunger woke him with a start. The mattress had both firmed up and moved overnight, and an unfamiliar rod of light fell across the carpet. What had Maureen done with the bedroom that its windows were on the wrong side? What had she done with the walls that they were lightly sprigged with flowers? It was then that he remembered.
He was in a hotel just north of Lodiswell. He was walking to Berwick, because Queenie Hennessy must not die. Harold would have been the first to admit that there were elements to his plan that were not finely tuned. He had no walking boots or compass, let alone a map or change of clothes. The least planned part of the journey, however, was the journey itself. He hadn't known he was going to walk until he started. Never mind the finely tuned elements, there was no plan. He knew the Devon roads well enough, and after that he would simply head north. Harold plumped his two pillows and eased himself to a sitting position. His left shoulder was sore, but otherwise he felt refreshed. He had enjoyed his best sleep in many years. There'd been none of the pictures that regularly came to him in the dark. The quilt covering his body matched the floral fabric of the curtains, and there was a stripped antique pine wardrobe, below which were parked his yachting shoes. In the far corner stood a sink, beneath a mirror. His shirt, tie and trousers were folded small as an apology on a faded blue velvet chair. A picture surfaced of his mother's dresses scattered through his childhood home. He didn't know where it had come from. He glanced at the window, trying to have a thought that would smudge the memory. He asked himself if Queenie knew he was walking. Maybe she was thinking about that even now. After the phone call to the hospice, he had followed the rising and turning of the B3196. Clear in his direction, he had passed fields, houses, trees, the bridge over the River Avon, and endless traffic had passed him. None of these made any real impression, except as one thing less between himself and Berwick. He had taken regular breaks to calm his breathing. Several times he had to adjust his yachting shoes and mop his head. On reaching the Lodiswell Inn, he had stopped to quench his thirst, and it was there that he spoke with the satellite dish salesman. The chap had been so bowled over when Harold confided his intentions that he clapped Harold on the back and told everyone in the bar to listen up, and when Harold offered the briefest outline, "I'm going to head up England until I hit Berwick," the satellite dish chap roared, "Good on you, mate!" It was with those words in mind that Harold had rushed out to telephone his wife. He wished she could have said the same thing. "I think not." Sometimes her words sliced down on his before they had even reached his mouth. After speaking to Maureen, his steps had grown heavier. You couldn't blame her for what she felt about him as a husband, and yet he wished it were otherwise. He had arrived at a small hotel with palm trees growing at a lopsided angle as if cowering from the coastal wind, and inquired about a room. He was used to sleeping alone, of course, but it was a novelty to be in a hotel. When he worked for the brewery, he had always been home by nightfall. Closing his eyes, he had slipped into unconsciousness almost as soon as he was lying down. Harold leaned against the soft upholstered headboard and crooked his left knee, clasping the ankle in his hands and drawing it up as far along his leg as he could, without losing balance and keeling over. He slipped on his reading glasses for a closer inspection. The toes were soft and pale, a little tender around the nails, and in the bulbous joint at the middle, and there was a possible blister on the way at the top of his heel. But considering his years and his lack of fitness, Harold was quietly proud. He performed the same slow but thorough inspection of his right foot. "Not bad," he said. A few plasters, a good breakfast, he'd be ready. He imagined the nurse telling Queenie that he was walking, and that all she had to do was keep living. He could see the features of her face as if she were sitting in front of him. Her dark eyes, her neat mouth, her black hair in tight curls. The picture was so vivid, he couldn't understand why he was still in bed. He must get to Berwick. He rolled his legs to the edge of the mattress and poked his heel towards the floor. Cramp. The pain roared up his right calf as if he had just stepped on an electric current. He tried to pull his leg back under the quilt, but that made it even worse. What was it you were supposed to do, point the toe away or flex them up? He hobbled out of bed and danced the length of the carpet, wincing and crying out. Maureen was right. He'd be lucky if he got as far as Dartmoor. Clinging to the windowsill, Harold Fry peered at the road below. It was already rush hour, and traffic was speeding in the direction of Kingsbridge. He thought of his wife making breakfast at 13 Fosbridge Road, and wondered if he shouldn't go back. He could fetch his mobile and pack a few things. He could look up the AA map on the internet and order some walking essentials. Maybe the travel book he had been given for his retirement and never looked at would offer useful suggestions. But planning his route would involve both serious consideration and waiting, and there was no time for either of those things. Besides, Maureen would only give voice to the truth he was doing his best to avoid. The days when he might expect her help, or her encouragement, or whatever it was he still wanted, were long since gone. Beyond the window, the sky was a fragile blue, almost breakable, flecked with wisps of cloud, and the treetops were bathed in warm golden light. Their branches swung in the breeze, beckoning him forward. If he went home now, if he even consulted a map, he knew he would never go to Berwick. He washed quickly, dressed in his shirt and tie, and then he followed the smell of bacon. Harold hovered outside the breakfast lounge, hoping it might be empty. He and Maureen could pass hours without saying a word, but her presence was like a wall that you expected to be there, even if you didn't often look at it. Harold took hold of the doorknob. It shamed him that after all those years at the brewery, he was still shy about a room full of strangers. He swung the door open, and so many heads swiveled to shoot a look at him that he remained glued to the handle. There was a young family, dressed in holiday clothes, a pair of older ladies, both wearing grey, and a businessman with a newspaper. Of the two remaining free tables, one was in the centre of the room, and the other was in the far corner, beside a potted fern on a stand. Harold gave a small cough. "Top of the morning to you," he said. Didn't know why. He hadn't a drop of Irish blood in him. It was the sort of thing his old boss, Mr. Napier, might have said. He hadn't a drop of Irish blood in him either, but he liked laughing at people. The hotel guests agreed that it was indeed a fine morning and returned to their English breakfasts. Harold felt conspicuous standing up, but thought it would be rude to sit when no one had invited him. A woman in a black skirt and top rushed through a pair of swinging saloon doors with a laminated sign above them, "Kitchen, no entry." She had auburn hair that she had somehow or other puffed up, the way women could. Maureen had never been one for blow-drying. "No time for beautification," she'd say under her breath. The woman delivered poached eggs to the two grey ladies and said, "Full breakfast, Mr. Fry?" With a stab of shame, Harold remembered. This was the same woman who had shown him to his room the night before. This was the woman whom, in a fit of exhaustion and elation, he had told he was walking to Berwick. He hoped she had forgotten. He tried to say, "Yes, please," but he couldn't even look at her now, and the words came out as more of a tremble. She pointed to the table in the centre of the room, which was the one he had been hoping to avoid. And as he moved, he realized that the odd sour smell that had been dogging him all the way down the stairs was in fact himself. He wanted to rush up to his room and scrub himself all over, but that would look rude, especially since she had asked him to sit, and he was now doing so. "Tea? Coffee?" she said.
"Yes, please."
"Both?" said the waitress. She gave him a patient look. Now he had three things to worry about. But even if she couldn't smell him, or remember about the walking part, she still might think him senile.
"Tea would be very kind," said Harold.
To his relief, the waitress nodded and disappeared through her swing doors, and the room fell briefly silent. He adjusted his tie and placed his hands in his lap. If he sat very still, perhaps the whole thing might go away. The two grey ladies began saying something about the weather, but Harold didn't know if they were speaking to one another or the guests in general. He didn't want to appear rude, but neither did he want to appear to be eavesdropping, so he tried to appear busy. He studied the sign on his table. No smoking. Then he read the one at the window. Would guests kindly refrain from using mobile phones? He wondered what had happened in the past that the owners felt the need to prohibit so many things. The waitress reappeared with a teapot and milk. He let her pour.
"At least you have a nice day for it," she said.
So she did remember. He took a sip of tea, but it scalded his mouth. The waitress was still hovering beside him.
"Do you do this sort of thing often?" she said.
He was aware of a tense stillness in the room that caused her voice to amplify. He glanced briefly up at the other guests, but none of them was moving. Even the potted fern seemed to hold its breath. Harold gave a small shake of his head. He wished the waitress would move on to someone else. But nobody seemed to be doing anything except looking at Harold. As a small boy, he had been so afraid of attention, he crept like a shadow. He could watch his mother applying lipstick or staring at her travel magazine without her knowing he was there. The waitress said,
"If we don't go mad once in a while, there's no hope."
She briefly patted his shoulder, and at last she retreated through the forbidden swing doors. Harold felt that he had become the focus of attention without anyone wanting to say it. Even setting down his teacup was something he could see only from outside himself, and it made a clank that startled him as it hit the saucer. Meanwhile, the smell was, if anything, getting worse. He berated himself for not thinking to rinse out his socks under the tap the night before. This was what Maureen would have done.
"I do hope you don't mind my asking," piped up one of the old ladies, turning to catch his eye. "My friend and I have been wondering what it is you are going to do."
She was a tall, elegant woman, older than himself, and wearing a soft blouse with her white hair pinned away from her face into a pleat. He wondered if Queenie's hair had lost its colour, whether she had grown it like this woman or cut it short like Maureen.
"Is that frightfully rude?" she said.
Harold assured her it wasn't, but to his horror the room was silent again. The second woman was altogether plumper, with a string of round pearls at her neck.
"We have a terrible habit of listening to other people's conversations," she said.
She laughed.
"We really shouldn't,"
they said to the guests in general. They spoke with the same cut-glass loud accent Maureen's mother had used. Harold found himself squinting in an effort to find the vowels.
"I think a hot air balloon," said one. "I think a wild swim," said the other.
Everyone looked expectantly at Harold. He took a deep breath. If he heard the sound of the words coming from his mouth enough times, maybe he would feel like the sort of person who could get up and do something about them.
"I'm walking," he said. "I'm walking to Berwick-upon-Tweed."
"Berwick-upon-Tweed," said the tall lady. "That must be about 500 miles, said her companion.
Harold had no idea. He had not yet dared to work it out.
"Yes," he agreed, "although it's probably more if you're hoping to avoid the M5.
He reached for his teacup and failed to pick it up. The family man in the corner glanced towards the businessman, and his lips buckled into a grin. Harold wished he hadn't seen, but he had, and they were right, of course. He was ridiculous. Old people should retire and sit at home.
"Have you been training for long?" said the tall lady.
The businessman folded over his newspaper and leaned forward, waiting for the reply. Harold wondered if he could lie, but knew in his heart he wouldn't. He also felt that the woman's kindness was somehow making him more pitiful, so that instead of feeling certain, he felt only shame.
"I'm not a walker. It's more of a spur-of-the-moment decision, a thing I must do for someone else. She has cancer."
The younger hotel faces stared, as if he had broken into a foreign language.
"Do you mean a religious walk?" said the plump lady helpfully. "A pilgrimage?"
She turned to her friend, who quietly began to sing, "He Who Would Valiant Be." Her voice rose, pure and certain, while her slim face pinkened. Again, Harold wasn't sure if it was for the benefit of the room in general or her friend.